Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center. It's Adam Carroll. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning. Yeah, just some light snow showers here this morning, but they're not going to last very long before we have a break in the action here for a good part of our day. We've been hanging out in the 30s here this morning in Park City. We'll get to about 41 for the high, but it should be a fairly cloudy day. Tomorrow we'll actually, later this evening actually, we see a disturbance come through. And it looks like a pretty good shot of some overnight snow. Not a ton, but we might see a quick couple inches here for Park City and several inches for the mountains. As we head towards sunrise, things should wind down tomorrow morning, but we could have some just slick secondary roads. Main thoroughfares should be okay because it's been so warm lately and they'll be treated. But we'll be a little cooler tomorrow. We'll only be in the upper 30s. We'll see more or less scattered snow showers here once that more or less the heavier band of snow moves through tomorrow. So we'll see maybe a little sun mixed in with those scattered snow showers, and then a little colder start to the morning the next several days as well, with a third round of snow coming in on Wednesday night into Thursday and lingering about much of the day Thursday. That could lead to several inches of snow in Park City. This is an area of low pressure that's tracking through the region, but is really slow moving. So it will continue to eject different disturbances into northern Utah over the next few days, and that will allow for the unsettled weather to continue, and at times we'll see the heavier snow compared to more of a lighter scattered snow. So it's more of a complicated next few day forecast because we'll continue to see unsettled weather through Friday with scattered snow showers around. Temperatures for the next several days after today will be in the mid to upper 30s. And then finally for your weekend, we more or less break out some sunshine. We gradually warm into the mid 40s before we return to a more of a colder, stormier pattern into next week. But, you know, this will be a nice little few days of some snow that we definitely need this time of year.
Okay, thanks, Adam. And we'll have a look at the backcountry and the fun with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. It's Trent. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Overnight those mountain temperatures crashed as that cold front came through northern Utah. This morning, the current temperatures, they're about 18 to 25 degrees Fahrenheit. excuse me there. And the winds have finally slowed and are currently blowing kind of from the westerly direction at 5 to 10, gusting into the 20s across most of those upper elevation ridge lines. As you heard, it's snowing lightly in some areas. It doesn't look like this morning is going to add up to all that much. But, hopefully 2 to 6 inches for the mountains, into tomorrow morning with another little disturbance tonight. The turning and riding conditions might be at an all-time low this morning. That's because any slope that's seen the sun from the past few days or has been melted slightly from the warm temperatures over the past few days is probably now frozen solid. If we get a couple inches of snow, that'll improve conditions drastically, but as of this morning, there's really not a lot of new snow to report just yet. We had no new avalanche activity reported yesterday, and really we're just going to continue with a normal caution. So basically what that means is that we generally have safe avalanche conditions with small avalanches in isolated areas possible. A couple of things to keep in the cerebral hard drive if you are heading out into the backcountry is that it is springtime now and conditions can change rapidly. So if for some reason the snow rate or the snowfall rate, how fast the snow falls from the sky, increases for a short period of time, we should start thinking about what we call loose dry avalanches running fast and far on slick bed surfaces. So, just 3-4 inches of snow falls and it's steep and somewhat icy slick, that snow can start, even with like a slope cut or a ski turn, it can start to pick up speed and carry down those slick surfaces. I really don't expect this to happen today, but again, if we start stacking snow up in a hurry, it could be sensitive for a short time period. And really, I think the biggest mountain hazard right now is slide for life conditions. So many slopes are now frozen solid and will be very slick. So if you're going to travel on a ridgeline or you know, above steep sustained terrain, I would say like ice axes, crampons, whippets, which are little, you know, axes that go on the ski poles, or any other sharp tools would be recommended, especially if you're going to be above anything kind of steep and sustained where a slide, you could go a long ways before you stop. So generally, the avalanche danger is low. And again, this means human-triggered avalanches are unlikely, but small avalanches in isolated areas are possible. And by small avalanches, I mean these loose, dry avalanches, and then possibly for some small pockets of fresh wind-drifted snow along those upper elevation ridgelines. I think both conditions for today are very manageable. And like I said, just to reiterate, slide-for-life conditions are probably the biggest concern out there for right now.
Okay. Thanks, Trent.
Thank you.
Good morning. Stay tuned in just a minute. We'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Later on, a conversation with Wasatch-backed Senator Ron Winterton with a recap of the 2021 legislative session. Then finally, Huntsman Cancer Institute event coordinator Kristen Van Leeuwen has details about this year's Pink Park City fundraiser going virtual. Stay tuned. Well, the Summit County Council meets in an early work session tomorrow to interview applicants for vacancies on the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission and Eastside Planning Commission, that before going into a closed meeting to discuss. Then they will reopen the work session just before 4 o'clock tomorrow. On the phone with a preview, I have Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie.
So Council is interviewing for two spots on the Snyderville Planning Commission, talking to incumbents Ryan Dickey and John Cusera. And then one other applicant has applied, also two spots on the Eastside Planning Commission. One incumbent, Amy Raldak, is retiring. And then Council will interview Don Sarchin, who is reapplying, and three other candidates. So it sounds like we've got some interest in the position, John.
Well, just as we have with all of our open committees and boards over the last few months, I'm interviewing, I believe, 12 or 13 candidates for library board at the present time. A lot of people wanting to get involved, but I think it's also indicative of just the amount of interest in our development issues in the county, and how people want to be part of shaping that in the future.
All right. Later on, the council will discuss whether they will be an anchor community within the community renewable energy program. We've talked about this before. In your view, Tom, what do we get if we're an anchor community?
Well, let me go back first and talk about mention that the council has put forth pretty aggressive renewable energy goals to support the lowering of greenhouse gas emissions associated not only with our government operations, but with all of our built environment within the county. So that's kind of the impetus of it. In going through this process of with the 23 other communities that are part of this initiative, the benefit of being an anchor community is that you immediately are part of the board that's going to negotiate the terms with Rocky Mountain Power and the Public Services Commission. You know, if you're not part of that anchor community part, you don't have that same credibility, let's say, within the board in being part of that. And the longer you delay to get into it, that these negotiations are going to begin as early as five communities have signed in to be those anchor communities. So that's what I see as the benefit.
So the cost mentioned in the staff report, a total of $57,000. We had heard a lot more. Is that just because Summit County is smaller?
Well, it's because, if all the anchor communities come in that were originally anticipated, our payments could be as low, our participation could be as low as about $21,500. We're estimating that $57,000 number as kind of the high side if some of the communities don't come in. So it's probably realistically somewhere in the range of those two numbers. That's with the ongoing knowledge of attending the meetings with the other 23 communities.
Okay, so it sounds like there's some favor of moving forward with this and becoming a...
Well, I think that's where staff is at. Now we get to listen to the council. We've certainly had some council interest with Glenn Wright and Chris Robinson attending some of these meetings in putting together these agreements with the 23 other communities. This will now get to a broader discussion with the five members.
All right, then at 4:50 tomorrow afternoon, the council will consider the neighborhood mixed-use zone. It seems like the county has been meeting intermittently about this for about a year. Why is this taking so long?
Well, I mean, it's a controversial subject. I mean, what we're talking about and what is projected in the general plan is providing areas of the county, mostly around our major transportation nodes, so Kimball Junction, Silver Creek, Silver Summit, those types of areas. And looking at those areas as places where more density could happen in an effort to not just sprawl on all lands in between and around that are still open to be developed. And, you know, of course, you know, we were talking earlier about the interest in being on planning commissions. You know, there's a lot of people that have a diverse set of opinions, whether you're a landowner or just a resident within the community, of where we should develop and where we shouldn't develop, and how much development we should allow in the county in both planning zones. And so this is one of those tools that that grew out of the last general plan changes. In order to try and control some of that development at the same time as putting some density in places that would more easily be served by transportation, especially public transportation.
Again, developer Henry Sigg is proposing to use this mixed-use zone as a way to develop his property along the Highway 40 frontage road. Is it possible that the county will also incorporate the Florence Gilmore parcel, which is owned by the county, into Sigg's proposal?
Well, it's hard to say at this point. We have received proposals from Mr. Sigg to possibly do some small land trades in order to facilitate some of the infrastructure around that area or make development more viable. But you know, the county really doesn't know what it wants to do with its property yet. We have projected and we're, you know, in the process of issuing bonds in order to advance a new county facility in that area. We know we have future, you know, long-term county needs and special district needs for expansion of public facilities. And then because of where that property is at, it has different levels of viability for different types of uses, some of them possibly being mixed use or actually utilizing what's described in a zone like this. But, you know, way too early to decide that. One of the things that we're looking at in conjunction to that is really what can the current transportation system handle, and what kind of improvements would need to be made in order to receive more density in that area. We already have Silver Creek Village that is not even close to built out yet that projects having to make transportation improvements. You know, you layer on more development in that area and that interchange and the associated road system with it is going to have to change in order to accommodate some of that.
Well, don't we have plans for that already? Something similar to what we saw at Jeremy and Pinebrook?
We don't have specific plans. We have discussions that have happened with UDOT, and then we have projections within different development agreements on how those developments will contribute to some of those improvements. Nothing within any current plans that would support that.
Okay, and I just wanted to clarify that the county building plans for near the Henry Sigg property, is that within the Gilmore parcel?
It would be on county property, that's correct.
Okay. Let's see. So actually, you would need, for you to go ahead and do that, you would need this mixed-use zone decided one way or the other, yeah?
No, not necessarily. I mean, it doesn't, the neighborhood mixed-use zone is being applied for by Mr. Sigg. Certainly we could do what we're projecting under the community commercial, but you're right that for the county's property, some type of rezone would have to happen.
All right, let's see. The council will also hold a public hearing and consider a decision on a proposal from the Colony HOA. They want to use 10 parcels for employee housing, maintenance facilities, and an HOA lodge with recreational amenities. It received a negative recommendation from the Snyderville Planning Commission. It sounds like the argument here boils down to, is this allowed under the Canyon Spa agreement? And is that the question that the council needs to ask themselves?
I think that's part of it. I think in paging through the staff report, and you know, this is kind of an intricate issue that I don't know the complete history on. It looks as if it's a question of whether, you know, use is one part of it, but also just whether the density is available to make this kind of conversion. The way I was reading the staff report, and I could be wrong, is that the density that the Colony is talking about possibly was already used in 2019. I'm going to be listening to this one closely to understand this one. This one is intricate.
All right. Anything else on the agenda you wanted to mention?
No. This is. But I did want to mention that, you know, you were talking to Pat Putt last week about the possibility of going back to live meetings in the near future. We're going to use the Planning Commission meetings to kind of test our systems and perfect those, and we're going to be keeping a close eye on what's happening throughout the state, and we'll probably be projecting sometime into the summer about doing hybrid meetings around the county, both live and virtual. So stay tuned to that.
Okay. Did want to ask you a couple of other questions. Dakota
sure.
Pacific isn't on the agenda. When does the council return to talk about this?
Well, I believe we have a special meeting scheduled for this week, and I'm trying to get into my calendar. Yes, Friday at 2 p.m., there is a scheduled council meeting specifically for the Dakota Pacific subject. And I think that's how the council is going to proceed, is with separate meetings open to the public, done the same way we do our regular council meetings, in order to concentrate on that subject for a couple hours at a time.
Okay. Also, any updates with regard to Hideout?
No, I don't have any updates. Really where we're at is we've been watching, you know, there's litigation proceeding, and I'll let the county attorney's office keep everyone up to date on that. And of course, we were watching the legislative session closely.
Well, and that's what I was going to mention. I didn't see a post-legislature report. Does that mean no news is good news?
No, there was good news. There was not so good news within the legislative session. But what we are doing is we're allowing the two people that are that usually keep track of this the most to take a little time off this week from talking about it before we revisit and gather ourselves. So you'll see something on a future agenda about that.
Okay, Tom, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, as the first anniversary of COVID-19 hits Utah and Park City, there's been lots of time for reflection since this strange new virus began making headlines because of its rampant spread and debilitating illness. But with very little understanding of the virus, Summit County made headlines a year ago as it ordered the local ski resorts, restaurants, bars, entertainment venues, and even churches to shut down in an attempt to slow the spread. There was conflicting messaging over wearing a mask. COVID counts became a daily occurrence. We saw a new lexicon of acronyms. And since then, nearly 2,000 people have died from the virus in Utah and more than 500,000 in the United States. Given the very name of COVID-19, a novel coronavirus, last March we all began charting a new course about how government, schools, business, and our communities would operate. Dr. Todd Vinto of Intermountain Healthcare remembers the call they got from the Centers for Disease Control last year to say that they wanted to bring a Utah resident who had come from Japan on a cruise ship to the Intermountain facility in Murray.
The reality is you do prepare for those things, and we had a lot of systems in place. But when you get that call, it's not until that moment that you think, oh, wow, this is real.
Every day, the experts learn something new about the public health emergency, which was difficult, he says, to constantly pivot.
I think the lesson there is that we learn things, we have to change, we have to adjust. People said not to use masks. That probably set us back quite a bit. Now we know that the data is incredible for masks and we need to use masks and we need to accept that. But you can see when you have these steep learning curve early on, sometimes folks will interpret that as, oh, maybe you don't know what you're doing. Well, reality is we really didn't. And why is that? We had a virus that we had never heard of, never seen until December of 2019. We had to learn very quickly.
Mark Jorgensen was the first patient to be treated in Utah for COVID-19. He and his wife were on a cruise ship when his wife became ill. His wife was put in a hospital in Japan to quarantine. He was able to leave once the State Department could arrange transportation to the States. He believes he caught the virus on that plane ride home. He was asymptomatic and felt fine the entire time, but continued to test positive.
I was totally asymptomatic. I had nothing. I felt just fine the whole time. And it was puzzling to me as to why all this fuss was being made about, you know, because I felt just totally normal and didn't have anything wrong at all. But people were learning about it and wondering what this all was and what was going to happen and how contagious it was and all that.
2 weeks later, on Friday, March 13th, Courtney Johansson, the managing partner of the Spur Bar and Grill in 350 Main on Park City's Main Street, got a call from an employee that had tested positive for the virus. He had been sick and had not worked for the last 10 days. After three trips to the doctor's office, he was finally diagnosed with COVID. Shortly after getting that call, Johansson received a call from Summit County Health Director Rich Bulla, who said she needed to get people out of the building because it wasn't safe.
I didn't think at the time to ask any questions. It seemed very serious. You know, he didn't want me to tell anybody why we were shutting down because they had a press conference the next day. So he said just to make up something. So I told my manager that the water was being turned off to the building and that everyone could finish their drink, but that was at the end of the night. So I think we got the bar empty around 11 p.m.
The health department required Johansson to get third-party cleaning crews in the bar before they would let her reopen, even though her one sick employee hadn't been to work in more than a week.
But I did spend $7,000 on the hazmat crew so that they could bring their news cameras up and show people in hazmat suits cleaning a bar.
That one confirmed case of community spread has been the only instance where a business was identified as having an employee who had tested positive for the virus. Because the Spur was singled out, Johansson says they've had to deal with unkind and untrue rumors. She says her staff was also treated poorly.
My staff really got beat up about it. You know, there were people who were kicked out of daycare because their parents worked at the Spur. There were people who couldn't go to their second jobs. They lost their second jobs because they worked at the Spur. You know, it wasn't just me that went through this. It was my family that is the Spur. And it's devastating. It was devastating and it still hurts.
She says she tries not to be bitter, yet the sadness remains.
Obviously, my emotions, I'm sad the way it went down. You know, I'm not bitter. I'm still heartbroken that we could have been singled out that way. And a year later, you know, I haven't been emotional about this in a year. And I'm emotional about it. It was an awful, awful time, and it sucks that we had to take the brunt of it, and I'm not sure why. And, you know, that's why I was hesitant to do this interview in the first place. I'm heartbroken.
Going from an occupancy of 500 to 175 this past year, she says, has been a huge blow to the business. She says they've had to adapt and overcome this last year, and they're still as busy as they can be given the occupancy limits. Still, she's positive they'll get through it. Dr. Vinto uses the analogy that the virus is a marathon, and he says we're not at the finish line yet.
We need to keep running the race until we hit the finish line. Don't worry about the finish line. It's going to come. But if we don't do the things to continue running, we're not going to hit the finish line. So we have to keep masking. We have to keep minimizing our gatherings and keeping socially distant and maximize the vaccine, all the tools in our preventive toolkit.
It's Dr. Vinto of Intermountain Healthcare. Again, as we approach that one-year anniversary of COVID-19 hitting Summit County. Well, the Utah legislature adjourned last Friday night after passing some 500 bills. On the phone to look with a look back, I have Utah Senator Ron Winterton, who represents Park City and the Wasatch County areas. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. So what was the big success of this year's session?
Well, from my perspective,
yes,
we were able to conduct the people's business without having any glitches, as far as we had a couple of senators that were out for a couple of weeks with COVID and a couple of interns. Other than that, I'd say there's probably close to 350 people on the Hill any given time, and we were able to pull off the legislative session very successfully. I felt like that we came to a good resolution with the governor's office as far as the pandemic measures that's been going on. So we brought that back in check, and hopefully the message for me anyway is that it comes back to the local levels, that we've restored the authority and power back to the local elected officials to deciding what goes on in our own areas.
Okay.
So that was a good compromise with them on passing that bill the last day of the session. I want to talk a little bit more
about that COVID-related bill, but I guess first I wanted to ask you, I mean, anything that you were disappointed that may not have gotten done this session?
Well, really, no. There was quite a few bills left on the reading calendars, quite a few that didn't make it out of committees or were held for interim studies. But overall, no, I'm very pleased that, you know, there was over 1,000 bills filed. We ended up passing the 503 of them. I think we heard a little over 700 of them on the floors of both chambers. So I think all in all that everybody was really focused on getting the work done, and I'm just pleased that we were able to do it.
Let's talk about a couple of those COVID-related bills. Senate Bill 195, which lawmakers passed, could hamstring the executive powers of the state. While this bill allows the power to declare emergencies and issue orders by the executive branch, such as face mask mandates or stay-at-home directions, after that, the legislature, after 30 days, the legislature would have to sign off. So if that bill had been in place a year ago, how would things have been different during these last 9 months, 10 months?
That's quite a question, in the fact that when you get 104 legislators all having their own personal opinions on that, things could have changed a little bit on that. I think that checks and balances are always good, which we didn't have that ability last year. And so just the fact that they would keep the legislature up to speed of what's going on. One of my probably biggest complaints about how this has been handled is that we pay the bills, but never was consulted on how they were doing this. They kept saying they were talking to the legislature. Well, they talked to the Speaker of the House and the Senate President, but as a legislature as a whole, they never did that until November. And it's really hard to try to explain to your constituents what's going on or why it's going on when, personally, I wasn't involved in the conversations. I would hear it on the news or something. That's how informed they were keeping us. So this bill will make it that we are informed, and we do have the ability to do the checks and balances on it. And if things are going to continue after 30 days, we do have a say in it.
And this is not only on the state level, but also on the local level. Is my understanding, our county council could have overruled its health director on the orders after 30 days that came out of the health department?
You're correct. Anything on a local nature, they could. And the reason that's there is there are communities that never did get affected by the COVID and yet have the stringent requirements of the masks and the protocols, and not to talk that down, but I think it's important that the locals have a say in it. I represent Daggett County. They went for 9 months, never had one case up there, and yet, you know, that little community needs to, they survive off from tourism, and they were pretty much shut down. And a community or a county like that, how do they pay the bills when they're shut down? And it really became devastating to them for survival. How do we help them out? And so they should have a say as to the restrictions that they put in place. And that's, in my opinion, one of the reasons why that's important, is that we elect local officials. They're the closest to us. They know what's going on the ground, and they should have some conversations on what goes on in their communities. That wasn't happening either. So I think that's a positive thing to always have local input.
Let's talk about the bill that would remove the mask mandate by April 10th, as well as removing the mandate in schools by July 1st. The bill's received a lot of backlash, a lot of concern here in Summit County. We've got lots of tourists in and out of town. That puts the local people at risk. So you're telling me that our health department will have the ability to keep that mask mandate in place?
Yes, if that's what your local elected officials determine would be best for your community, yes, they have that ability to keep those in place. You know, we passed the bill, excuse me, but April 10th is when, as a legislature, along with the governor's office and the state health department, determined that, yeah, we will be in a good place, a safe place by April 10th. We'll have, between now and the next month, we'll have over another 250,000 people vaccinated. You look at the number of cases that we've had. We feel like with the vaccinations, the cases, we will have better than half the population already through this crisis, and feel like that we'll be in a better place, and that the restrictions should be relax some so that we can get back to having free enterprise and commerce going on. So we're not trying to second guess the medical profession, but even in their opinion, they think that by that time we'll be safer to be able to start opening things up. Right now, if you're in a moderate zone of the state, you can go to theaters or, you know, activities, sit one again or side by side, as long as you're both masked up, and then gatherings of 50 or less, we feel like that we can do that safely also. And so I don't think that we've relaxed all of the restrictions, but we're going to leave that up to the locals to decide how best to do that. If your case counts are high still, then that's a contributing factor that you guys have control of that, not the state.
Since the legislature's really only mandated job is to set a budget, let's talk about that for a minute. We entered the session with an extra $1.4 billion in one-time spending this year. The budget was much higher than anticipated. What do you think led Utah to be financially prepared like this? Was it all the CARES Act money?
Last year, what we did, we passed six different budgets. Each time we'd go into special session, we had to address the budget. And once this, as we ended the session last year, we actually pulled back a lot of the things that we had funded. We pulled that back because we have a constitutional balance here of the budget. So we can't spend money we don't have. So we did pull in a lot of money back from what we had allocated last year. And then as we met special session-wise, we would release some money to pay the bills and that. And then with what the federal funding came into the state of Utah, we use that for the purposes of the COVID, fighting it or, you know, that. And so then we had money that we had out of our general budget set aside. And as we are coming out of this, we still had some money left over. So our surplus is because we managed it well enough last year. And we're probably in the top three states in the nation that are as sound as we are, because we do have those conservative values of not going into debt to live for the moment instead of, or into the future.
Yeah. So you were able to restore all of the money that had been cut from education and actually give some more for this year's, next year's school. But what about everything else that was cut? Were you able to restore all of that funding as well?
As far as I understand, we did restore everything that was cut last year. Plus, we were able to do a little bit more. I know in education, we increased WPUs by 6%. We were able to give our teachers and school staff, supporting staff, $1,500 each in a stipend. That should be coming here in the next 2 or 3 weeks. We really appreciate all of them stepping up and doing the things that they've done. And I know it doesn't say enough, but we were able to do that. And, that was unanimous that we do that. So we have to be very proud as a legislature in what we've been able to accomplish this year.
And again, lawmakers had committed $400 million to public education plus, even before the sessions started, again, with the increase in WPU and the school teacher bonuses. Are you going to be able to keep up, though, with the constitutional mandates required by Amendment G in future years here?
We believe we will. Our budget, we have ongoing commitments, and Amendment G was an ongoing commitment. And so, yes. And then one-time money, like surplus money, because we can't identify exactly, is that going to be ongoing revenue or is this a one-time thing? That's where we come up with the money to do other projects or to fund something at a one-time. And if we happen to have surplus next year, then, we say, okay, can we identify where it is coming from? And can we make that an ongoing commitment? And so it's a process we work off from. We actually, if you look at it, we do about 3 years projection on our budget, working off from fiscal year as far as July to June. And so we spend basically 2 years there, but we have to project the third year to make sure that we have that balance of a budget. So it's a great process, and we have some great leadership in making sure and steering us that we're always meeting the constitutional requirements of a balanced budget.
One other issue I wanted to bring up was Senate Bill 167. This was your bill about the Utah film economic incentives. Originally, this would have raised the economic incentives or tax credits from about $6.8 million to $15 million. It was amended to $10 million and then later $8.3 million. So how much good will that extra $1.6 million in tax credits do to incentivize the film industry?
Well, it will help. I did end up getting I put in a request for funding for another $1.5 million, which that was cut back. I think I got a little over $500,000 there. So all in all, they're going to have just shy of $10 million to work with to put back into the incentive programs. I did have a commitment, and we will be studying it this summer during interim. We're going to have some comparatives with the other states and other avenues in which we could help support this industry. A lot of people do not like the incentives. My opinion is if we don't have something on the table that will be continue to be a flyover state and people won't stop to even talk to us. And so we need to have something there, but I think there's other things we could do that they will still consider us as they go to finding a location to film. We do have, I did have one producer, a director call and said he had two series that he wanted to put in applications for to come to Park City to film. They love our facilities there, and the fact that we have 100% of the support teams and the vendors here, that they don't have to bring those from other states, is one of the things that is most appealing to the industry. And so I'm committed to work on this this coming year to see what we can do to make that better in the years to come. And found out that there is a lot of support for this industry. When I started the bill, I did it on my own. Nobody came to me. And so once we got the ball rolling, I had all kinds of support coming out and people that want to get in and be in on the formation of a better program. So I'm looking forward to the summer for that.
Okay, Ron, I've got to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you. You guys have a good day there.
That's State Senator Ron Winterton. Well, the 4th annual Pink Park City will be held virtually this year. That after having to cancel the event last year as the pandemic had just started to make its way into the state. On the phone with details is the Huntsburg Cancer Institute event coordinator, Kristen Van Leeuwen. She's got details. Good morning to you, Kristen.
Good morning.
So like last year, like so many other events, you had to pivot and the ski day to conquer all cancer was postponed until this year. But with the pandemic still in force here, you decided to go forward, but we'll be doing it virtually. Talk to us about how that's going to work.
Yeah, so we knew that, especially since we weren't able to hold it last year, we had to do something this year. Cancer doesn't stop, so we obviously still need to raise funds for cancer research. So this year we've switched entirely to a virtual platform. So people can participate by registering for a free fundraising page and going out and fundraising themselves. They can simply donate to a friend who has a fundraising page, or they can donate in honor of a loved one. And all of that money goes to cancer research at Huntsman Cancer Institute.
Okay, so where's that page for people to do that?
Yeah, so all it is just pinkparkcity.com. You can do all of those three options off of that website. And we also have links in our social media channels as well on Facebook and Instagram, too.
Yeah. And even though we're still skiing during the pandemic, the decision was made not to gather. And I guess just given the fact that cancer patients are one of those in the group that don't want to get COVID, huh?
Yeah, we knew, the whole purpose of the day is to honor and celebrate those who have been affected by cancer. So a lot of the people that we do have attend the event, may be going through cancer treatments or be caregivers of those going through cancer treatments. And we just really didn't want to put anyone at risk while things were still so uncertain, 4 or 5 months ago.
Sure. So the goal is to raise how much then?
So this year is $225,000, and right now we have raised just over $182,000. So we're about 80% of the way to our goal this year.
Okay, and how does that compare with years before COVID?
It's actually really not bad. In our first year, we made about $80,000, and then the following year, we had a huge jump and raised double that. Mm. So I think we're right on track and we're doing good, and we're just excited to have everyone join us virtually throughout the rest of this month to help meet our goal.
All right. And then how is the money used?
So 100% of the funds all go to cancer research at Huntsman Cancer Institute, whether that's to seed a new research idea, provide research equipment to all of our researchers, but all of it goes to cancer research.
Okay. And I guess why Park City?
We actually had our two co-founders. One of them actually lives in Park City, and we really just saw a great opportunity to break through the mold of Park City and do some stuff up there where we aren't usually there as often as we are in the Salt Lake Valley. So we thought it was a great opportunity to meet new people and kind of dip our toe in the water of all that Park City holds.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to tell our listeners?
I think just go to pinkparkcity.com and donate. Our donations will go through the end of the month, and even, $5 here, $10 here helps in any regard.
Okay, Kristen, thank you. Thanks for your time this morning, Kristen.
Thank you so much.
Well, just over 100 years ago, Americans were battling over workers' rights, police brutality, freedom of speech, and political corruption in ways that would feel remarkably familiar today. Kathy Lenigan reviews Jess Walter's latest historical novel, The Cold Millions, for this month's book review.
When you visit the underground exhibit floor of the Park City Museum on Main Street, you're met with the poorly lit, cold, and cramped jail, which has been carefully preserved as it existed in the early 1900s. It was on a visit to this exhibit when I first heard of the Wobblies, a labor rights organization that worked to establish some protections for Park City mine workers. It's tempting to believe the exhibit was the inspiration for Jess Walter's latest novel of historical fiction. In The Cold Millions, the year is 1909, and the protagonist is Rye Dolan, a destitute teenager who arrives in Spokane, Washington. He finds his older brother has joined the workers' rights organization known as the Wobblies and has made dangerous enemies of the mine owners, the lumber barons, and much of the wealthy class. Walter's skillful storytelling delivers an immersive experience of the desperation of the times, while still giving the reader a tense and engaging read. As in his previous novels, each of the secondary characters is fully articulated and human enough to bring the entire world to life. Many of the characters are actual people from history, such as the fiery and dedicated Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who crisscrossed the region, agitating for freedom of speech, fair wages, and worker safety. From the stinking, fetid, and overcrowded jail, to the conditions in the lumberjack and railroad camps, to the polished and marbled halls of the gentlemen's clubs, the world of Spokane in 1909 is fully alive in this novel. The Cold Millions reads like a thriller, while illuminating a period of history not often explored. It's available today at your local library. For KPCW, this is Kathy Lanigan.
And the Stuyvesant Basin Planning Commission has a formidable agenda on their hands at their regular session tonight. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more on that.
The Snyderville Commission begins their electronic meeting on March 9th at 4:30 with a work session where they will discuss amendments to the Snyderville General Plan and Code. Also, the Snyderville planners will be introduced to a proposal for Anaya's Market, which has had to leave its longtime location near Park City's Bonanza Drive and now wants to move to Lower Silver Creek, northeast of the Bell Station. County Development Director Pat Putt told us the project is looking for a plat amendment, low-impact permit, and conditional use permit. It would include two buildings of a combined 28,500 square feet. One structure would include a market, cafe, and deli. The second would accommodate small retail and offices. Both are two-story buildings, and the upper stories would have a combined 10 units, mostly for employee or affordable housing. The regular session starts at 6 p.m. First off, the Planning Commission will hold a public hearing and consider a decision for the Silver Summit Academy, which is now located in the Silver Creek Industrial Park off Highway 40. The South Summit School District is asking to allow the academy to expand into an existing office building, which is next to them on the same lot. That structure is about 11,000 square feet and two stories. Next up, a project is returning, the Wyoway Ranch Indoor Riding Arena and Horse Boarding Facility in Lower Silver Creek. Last November, the Snyderville Commission voted against a conditional use permit for the project. The ranch appealed to the Summit County Council last month. In the end, the appellant asked to be sent back to the Snyderville Commission with some revisions in color and materials, and council voted for the remand. Then the Planning Commission will discuss Highland Flats, which is proposing 410 rental units on a site over 41 acres. Located between Highland Drive and the intersection of Interstate 80 and Highway 40. They will consider a recommendation on a general plan amendment and a rezone after a public hearing 2 weeks ago where they got 55 comments, heavily in opposition to the project. Finally on the agenda, another proposal for Highland Estates is up for a public hearing. The request is to convert an existing 13,000-square-foot home on Highland Drive into a group home for a transition program called ROOTS, or Retaining Our Original Truth, designed to assist young women who are struggling with depression, anxiety, or other trauma. The Planning Commission will consider a decision on a conditional use permit. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
This is KPCW Park City.